Cedric Muhammad.
Mr. Calvini, we'd like to know why the IBBC, a bank, would be purchasing hundreds of millions of dollars worth of missile guidance and control systems from your company.
The IBBC has purchased billions of dollars worth of Silkworm missiles from the People's Republic of China, which they have resold to clients in the Middle East, contingent upon the missiles being equipped with Vulcan guidance systems. My company is one of only two in the world which produce the Vulcan.
Who's the other?
Sunay, Ahmed Sunay.
Of Turkish Aerotech.
But why is the bank committing so much of its capital and resources to the sale of these missiles?
It's a test. Small arms are the only weapons used in 99% of the world's conflicts. And no one has the capacity to manufacture them faster and cheaper than China. What Skarsen is attempting to do is to make the IBBC the exclusive broker of Chinese small arms to the Third World. And the missile deal is the gateway transaction.
Yeah, but billions of dollars invested simply to be a broker. There can't be that much profit for them.
No, this is not about making profit from weapon sales. It's about control.
Control the flow of weapons, control the conflict.
No. The IBBC is a bank. Their objective isn't to control the conflict. It's to control the debt that the conflict produces. You see, the real value of a conflict, the true value, is in the debt that it creates. You control the debt, you control everything. You find this upsetting, yes? But this is the very essence of the banking industry. To make us all, whether we be nations or individuals, slaves to debt.
Sober, stimulating, and hot. It's the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Program. Cedric Muhammad.
Now let's get it all in perspective. For all y'all enjoyment, a song y'all can step with. Y'all appointed me to bring rap justice, but I ain't 5-0, y'all know it's Nas, yo. Great goose and a whole lot of hydro. Only describe us as soldier survivors. Stay laced in the best, well-dressed with finesse in the white tee, looking for white meat. Dog girl who fly and talk so nicely. Put her in the coupe so she can feel the nice breeze. We could drive to the city, no doubt, but don't say my car's topless. Say the tea, this is out. Newness, here's the anthem. Put your hand up that you wish with, count your loot with. Push the pool stick in your new crib. Same hand that you hoop with. Swing around like you stupid. King of the town. Yeah, I've been that. You know I click clack. Where you and your men's at? Through the smurf, through the wop, baseball bat.
Rooftop
like you bring an 88 back. They shoop, shoop, shoop. I made you look. You a slave to a page in my rhyme book. Getting big money, playboy, your time's up. Where them gangsters, where them dimes at?
They shoot.
I made you look. You a slave to a page in my rhyme book. Getting big money, playboy, your time's up. Where them gangsters at? Where them dimes at? This ain't rapping, this is street hop. Now get up off your tail like your seat's hot. My lobs again lit up the reefer. Trunk of the car, we got the street sweeper. Don't start none, won't be none. No reason for your man to
Cedric
panic
Muhammad.
You don't wanna see no ambulances. Knock a pimp's drink down in his pimp cup. That's the way you get Timberland up. Let the music diffuse all attention. Ball of convention, free admission. Hustlers, dealers, and killers can move swift. Girls get close, you can feel where the tools kept. All my just coming homies, parolees. Get money, leave the beef alone slowly. Get out my face, you people so phony. Pull out my waist, the eagle 440. They shoot. I made you
Cedric Muhammad.
You a slave to a page in my rhyme book. Getting big money, playboy, your time's up. With them gangsters, with them dimes at. They shoot.
You are tuned into the watch.
You a slave to a
Cedric
page
Muhammad
in my rhyme book. Getting big money,
chair.
Playboy, your time's up. With them gangsters at, with them dimes at.
Cedric Muhammad.
December 9th, 2009. I want to welcome you to the hottest show in the diaspora, simulcasting. CedricMuhammad.com, BlackElectorate.com, BlackCoffeeChannel.com. Hottest show in the diaspora. Big show today, in case you haven't heard. I want to welcome a lot of new first-time viewers and listeners. As I always say, you are the most important people in the room. Let me go through the captain's blog. A lot on the table to discuss today. If Glenn from Philly is listening, maybe he'll be able to find time in between currency fluctuations to bear witness to this. I want to talk about something called the dollar carry trade. Neil, was it Kashkari? Leaving the TARP program, United States Treasury, to go to PIMCO. Now, I actually one day said that PIMCO was spelled P-I-M-P-C-O. I said this live on Sirius Radio. PIMCO. It's not, there's no P in it. No second P. It's just P-I-M-C-O. But my question is, how and why is it possible for the man who was involved with so much of the bank bailout to go to a company that is poised to benefit from the purchase and sale of toxic assets? Neil Kashkari of PIMCO. Job summit. Last week I had to be a little critical of my beloved brother president, Barack Obama. We'll take a look at the job summit. And I want to get the perspective of two economists that I respect. One on the left, Paul Krugman, and one on the right, Bruce Bartlett, who has appeared on this show, as many of you know. My favorite white Republican, Bruce Bartlett, brother Bruce, going toe-to-toe last night on NewsHour. I want to talk about Afghanistan because I think some of you all have been rope-a-doped into forgetting how the United States got into conflict post-September 11th. Does capturing Osama bin Laden still matter to you? If not, I have a question for you, and we can talk about it. If it does matter to you, I have a question for you, and we can talk about it as well. Does capturing Osama bin Laden matter to you still? If not, why not? If so, why so? Allen Iverson. Yep, it does look like he has lost a step, but that does not matter. Now, the key to this thing working, Allen Iverson is re-signed with the Philadelphia 76ers, for those that don't know and don't care. This is how I justify paying for NBA League Pass. This thing can work if Elton Brand does not lose his self-esteem. I'll talk about that a little bit later, maybe hour number five when I do Seducation. But Elton Brand is the key to Allen Iverson working in Philadelphia. We'll talk about the Climate Control Conference. I have a Wall Street Journal editorial I want to run by you, as well as some international news. We don't do CNN, Fox, or MSNBC on this program, unless they start promoting my book now, then it's something totally different. I'll be waving at MSNBC Peacock. You wouldn't believe they have me on to talk about my book. Is France involved in another regime change attempt in Africa? Talk about what's going on in Guinea. Is the hidden hand of the French on the African continent again rearing its ugly manifestations? I'm going to give you another form of evidence that Magic Johnson absolutely is in love with Larry Bird. You got the audio evidence of that. Now, big guest today. Top billers, I call them. Wyclef Jean will be joining us. Today's program, for those that don't have it, I want to talk about the new mixtape album, From the Hut to the Projects to the Mansion, the new Wyclef project. Yeah, this is Stanley Clark. For those that don't know, I like to play Stanley Clark, another artist my father put me up on at a very young age. And Steven Silbiger, the Jewish phenomenon. For those of you, he's no stranger to me or BlackElectorate.com family. We did maybe the most in-depth interview with Stephen at Black Electorate in 2003. The book is called The Jewish Phenomenon, Seven Keys to the Enduring Wealth of a People. So Steven Silbiger will be joining us later. Let me read the back of the last edition. There's a new edition out, revealing facts and statistics behind the Jewish phenomenon. This is on the back cover of the book. It says Jews make up only 2% of the total U.S. population, yet 45% of the top 40 of the Forbes 400 richest Americans are Jewish. One third of all American multimillionaires are Jewish. The percentage of Jewish households with income greater than $50,000 is double that of non-Jews. And on the other hand, the percentage of Jewish households with income less than $20,000 is half that of non-Jews. 20% of professors at leading universities are Jewish, and 40% of partners in leading New York and Washington, D.C. law firms are Jewish. 25% of all American Nobel Prize winners are Jewish. So we're going to talk to Steven Silbiger about the Jewish phenomenon. Looking forward to that. It has been, what, 7 years since he and I talked almost. So Wyclef Jean, Steven Silbiger, big day on our show. Now let me put the camera on me because I want to show you why. I want to make a point. I am traumatized. I want you to see why. Now, I'm not disrobing. That's inappropriate. But let me show you that I do not have a white t-shirt on today. Hold on. This is a black t-shirt of a rapper. I don't want you to see the whole thing, but this is, I do not have white on today. Now, for those of you that don't know, it's been 2.5 years since my partner, brother Bernard, and I, we started the Paul Williams White Tea Nation movement. Paul the Punisher Williams, the great welterweight / junior middleweight / middleweight. The man is 6'2". He can fight in about 4 different weight classes. I never think that Paul is going to breeze through his opponents. But Saturday night, I was not prepared for what I saw. I've been traumatized ever since. Let me give you the audio that explains why I don't have a white t-shirt on today. I want to play for you. Perfect timing, right? Stanley Clark, I want to play for you. Let me give you the image of our fallen leader, Paul Williams. Listen closely.
Martinez says he's fighting this fight in memory of the late Vernon Forrest. Were they friends? No. He says he never met Forrest, but when he learned about Forrest's outreach to developmentally disabled adults and impoverished children, he developed a fondness for him, and he misses him and fights in his honor tonight. Hard right hand, and Williams goes down, and Martinez has evened the round.
9-9.
Brilliant.
Coming in, counterpunch.
Oh, man.
Williams landed one big shot in the round. Martinez landed two.
We are going to talk about climate control in just a minute. The Copenhagen Summit. I'm going to take you to Russia, to the Middle East, to France to get the perspective abroad. But this is breaking news. Our leader, Paul the Punisher Williams, the leader of the White Tea Nation, the man who I have called the greatest boxer on the scene today, pound for pound, superior to Floyd Mayweather, got knocked down, and I believe he lost the fight. The fight went the distance. Look up on the screen. That's how our leader looked at the end of the fight. Take a good look at Paul Williams. Now let's hear from him. Here's what our leader had to say post-fight interview last Saturday night.
Congratulations, Paul, on, first of all, engaging in a classic fight. What are your thoughts right now?
You know, a good fight, man. You know, bring out.
Hold on. The speech is slurred now. Now, I've been traumatized because I believe this may be the fight that beat some of the spirit and health out of Paul Williams. You all know that boxing is a brutal sport. Roy Jones went through this in his first fight with Antonio Tarver in 2003. This fight between Paul Williams and Sergio Martinez was so brutal, I think it may have taken 2 years off the career of Paul Williams. Listen to our leader's speech patterns now.
War, like I said, you know what I'm saying?
Let's go from the top.
Congratulations, Paul, on, first of all, engaging in a classic fight. What are your thoughts right now?
You know, a good fight, man. You know, bring out the war. Like I said, you know what I'm saying? I wasn't going to try to box him. I'm going to try to make it a war, make him fight me. You know, that's what we had to do.
Early on, you scored a knockdown. By the end of the round, he scored a knockdown that seemed to really hurt you. Were you hurt?
No, you know what I'm saying? He stung me like I stung him and stuff, you know. I had to get up and show what a warrior made out of, you know what I'm saying? That's part of my business, first time ever being knocked down and stuff. But, you know, I've been knocked down before in the gym, so I had to get up and show what a true champion made out of, you know what I'm saying? I had to put it on.
No one would question your heart until now, certainly not after a performance like this. But in terms of the matchup itself, he was catching you time and again with big right hooks that seemed to have an effect on you, even though you kept coming. What was the effect of those hooks?
I mean, they let me know that I was in there with a true champion and stuff, but, you know, through all the training and those things, switching up and kind of threw me off a little bit, and I started getting him a rhythm around the fourth round. But, you know, he's a warrior, man, and I liked it that, you know what I'm saying, because I know he's going to get some big shots in, and I'm going to get some big shots in, too.
Did you think you had to pull out the late rounds to win the fight?
Oh, most definitely. My man was telling me, you know what I'm saying, you got to, hey, if you want it, you got to go get it. And so, you know what I'm saying, he's like, you got to make him fight. You got to keep throwing punches and stuff. I couldn't get the body work like I wanted to, you know what I'm saying, but I just did what I had to do, you know, to keep throwing and make him fight me.
Do you have any thoughts at the moment of wanting to do it again?
Oh, if Mr. Peterson, Al, and Dan, and HBO want to see it again, hey, I'm all in for it.
Congratulations. Amazing fight, Paul.
No, you do not congratulate no person who took punishment like Paul Williams took against Sergio Martinez. We'll go over this in hour number 5, Seducation, but I had to just deal with the breaking news. As many of you all know, you've been wearing white t-shirts like me because of this man. Question I want to ask now, does it matter to you at all that Osama bin Laden has not been captured? I mean, I just have to ask, because in the commentary and the analysis that I'm listening to since President Obama made his speech regarding the surge in Afghanistan, it is almost as if it is an irrelevant point whether it was proven that he was responsible for September 11th and whether he is caught or not. That's the impression I get from watching American media. Let me put a picture up of Osama bin Laden in case you forgot what he looks like. I had to listen to BBC News. Here's what I heard on BBC News. Some people have not forgotten. And the question now is Osama bin Laden bigger than ever? Is he now an icon or a martyr if he were to be proven to be dead or killed? Not an irrelevant question according to the top military commanders of the United States Army, although you would not know that listening to CNN, MSNBC, or Fox. Listen up.
For a man whose whereabouts are unknown and whose appearances are restricted to the occasional video recording, Osama bin Laden retains an iconic status for extremists around the world. That was the verdict of America's military chief in Afghanistan when he appeared before a Senate committee on Tuesday. He's continuing his testimony today, Wednesday. As Mike Woodridge reports, U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates admits there's been no reliable information on bin Laden for years.
U.S. forces pounding the Tora Bora Mountains in Afghanistan in 2001. But Osama bin Laden, believed at the time to be hiding somewhere in these mountains, survived the efforts to capture or kill him. 8 years on, he remains just as elusive, his whereabouts the subject of continuing controversy. And now a new acknowledgement from the U.S. commander in Afghanistan, testifying in Congress, of the influence bin Laden still wields.
How important is it that we find and bring to justice Osama bin Laden, and what effect would that have on our effort there?
Sir, I believe he is an iconic figure at this point whose survival emboldens al-Qaeda as a franchising organization across the world. I don't think it would not defeat al-Qaeda to have him captured or killed, but I don't think that we can finally defeat al-Qaeda until he is captured or killed.
Since President Obama's announcement that an extra 30,000 troops will be sent to help finish the job in Afghanistan, U.S. officials have talked of the likelihood of a new effort to go after the al-Qaeda leader. It's 11 years since he gave an interview to the American network ABC.
I just got to jump in and ask you all. I mean, is it irrelevant that Osama is not brought up? I was about to say Obama, I know. I just don't understand. How do we go from, you know, Saddam Hussein, iconic villain, Muammar Gaddafi, iconic villain, Fidel Castro, Kim Jong-il, you know, these titulary leaders, these figureheads, or the embodiment of a certain ideal, a nation state? It seems to matter that there is a visible leader with every other kind of movement rather than this war on terror. It's as if it's irrelevant now. Now, some of you believe that Osama bin Laden is a figment of intelligence agencies. Others say he's a legitimate figure in the Muslim world. Some people are not sure, don't even know how he evolved. We can talk about that. Osama bin Laden is actually a diasporic personality. And there's a reason why his family is so influential and why he would be in a position to be either depicted the way he is or to actually do what he's accused of. But I just wonder why the American public doesn't seem to care anymore, or if they do care, why they have accepted no one talking about it. Now, here's a military commander saying Osama bin Laden is now an iconic figure. He's bigger than ever, and it is essential to capture or kill him in order to defeat this. Why is that not being put front and center?
We believe that the worst thieves in the world today and the worst terrorists are the Americans.
But as recently as this September, another audio message surfaced purportedly from him, taunting President Obama as powerless to stop conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan. Reflecting the widely held view that bin Laden is most likely to be hiding out in Pakistan, close to the Afghan border, Britain's Prime Minister recently challenged the Pakistani authorities to do more to find him.
We've got to ask ourselves why 8 years after September the 11th, nobody has been able to spot or detain or get close to Osama bin Laden.
But Pakistan, now taking the fight against extremism directly into the tribal areas, insists it's not responsible for the fact that Osama bin Laden remains at large. And the Americans are now saying he could sometimes be on the Pakistan side of the border and sometimes on the Afghan side. Clearly, intelligence will be as important as force if he is to be captured or killed. Mike Wooldridge, BBC News.
Well, with me is our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera. I want to look at that intelligence question that Mike's just raised towards the end of his report. But firstly, Gordon, I mean, it's an extraordinary admission, and it kind of begs the question, what on earth have you been doing for 8 years, you know, since 9/11?
Exactly. I think at the time of 9/11, if you'd predicted that he wouldn't be found, I think people would have been shocked. We've almost got used to the idea that he's able to hide. I think the reality is that if he is hiding in that border region, he's not in contact with many people and he's on the move. So he's not operationally able to do very much because he's trying to stay alive and stay away from those drones which are flying above the border region and which have been taking out the lower level of leaders just below bin Laden. That's the theory. There's been speculation, is he in Pakistan, is he in Afghanistan, does he move between the two? A few people think he might be dead, and that some of the videos and audios have been manufactured to hide that. But the truth is, there have been very few good intelligence leads for the US to go on in the last few years.
Well, let's look at that intelligence, because they've obviously got enough intelligence, as you say, to take out that lower level. What is it about Osama bin Laden and the way that's organised, his security is organised, that makes it just such a challenge?
Well, the lower levels are, if you like, the operational commanders, the people just below that. And those are the people who meet militants who maybe come from overseas and then for training or being sent on missions. And so by definition, they have to have contact with the outside world, which can then be watched, spotted, and then these drones have been taking them out. And so they've had a pretty high death rate amongst that level. But bin Laden hasn't, on the whole, been in contact with anyone. He's been literally just moving around, we think. And by not going into contact and not actually operationally commanding al-Qaeda, he's been able to stay out of contact and out of range, if you like, of the kinds of intelligence assets and the tracking that the US has been engaged in.
What I find interesting is, if he's a man who's not been operational and yet there's been continued extremist attacks and so on, how important is he as important as McChrystal says he is?
Well, I think that was quite interesting what McChrystal was raising there, which is that he is of symbolic value. In other words, it's the symbol of bin Laden rather than what he's actually doing which matters. And that's why McChrystal was saying that it's important to get him, because as long as he's seen as still being at large, there is this sense in which he can continue to have a symbolic, iconic power, and the al-Qaeda franchise, which is so important, will continue to at least survive. And only by removing him from the equation can this be put to rest. So I think there is that sense, even if he's not operationally commanding anything, that he's still important.
All right, Gordon, thanks very much.
Okay. If you all have an opinion, I want to hear it, and I would like to pursue you with some questions. Because if Osama bin Laden doesn't matter now, why did he matter so much on September 11th? How do you stop mattering if you are responsible for the greatest attack in the history of continental United States soil, according to some people? Some people in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Rosewood, and Philadelphia might disagree, but I'm just saying. I just think you have to really wonder, what is this all about? You're playing musical chairs with soldiers, moving them from one country to another. We're getting out of one country, going into another country. I mean, what is this really all about? The person who's responsible for 9/11 matters as the justification for going into Afghanistan now, 9 years later, doesn't matter. Yet the military commander is now saying it does matter. He's now, Osama bin Laden is now an iconic figure. Shane from Houston says, Cedric, I was not directly affected by the events on September 11th, but my interest in our government finding bin Laden was lost when we invaded Iraq. Really, I don't give a damn. This is Shane from Houston. I thought that Osama bin Laden was a causal factor in the war on terror. How does he not no longer matter? Well, it turns out he does matter, according to these generals. Now, wouldn't it be something if all of a sudden Osama bin Laden is caught? What would that mean? What if he's rolled out? Let me know how you feel about that. Let's go get a little climate control friendly here. Copenhagen, the scene of the great debate. Let me give you a little bit of a Wall Street Journal editorial on this conference, which I know many of you are paying attention to. Some of you could care less about anything dealing with global warming. I'd like to find out why. Some of you question the science of it. We'll talk about that for the remainder of this hour. Let me give you a little visual of the globe at the Climate Change Summit. Yesterday's Wall Street Journal Review and Outlook, the Copenhagen concoction. Wall Street Journal says, for months, the UN Climate Change Summit that began yesterday in Copenhagen has been billed as the world's last best hope to match the scientific consensus on global warming with a policy consensus. But now it turns out there is a little of either. And Copenhagen looks like it will go down as one of the most remarkable cases of political hubris in recent memory. That's not bad. That's not a bad outcome, given the ambitions of Copenhagen's organizers to impose heavy new carbon taxes on top of a struggling world economy. The Australian Senate last week defeated Prime Minister Kevin Rudd's cap and trade legislation, largely due to its job-killing potential in the coal-producing continent. And Jarin Ramesh, India's environment minister, said Thursday there is no question of India accepting a legally binding emission reduction cut. China has promised to cut the rate of growth in its carbon emissions, which would nevertheless double over the next decade. As for the U.S., it has become clear, even to liberals, that it was not the Bush administration alone that was standing in the way of a global climate deal. Last Thursday, 9 senators sent a letter outlining the terms of their support for cap-and-trade legislation, including that every other country enact and enforce carbon legislation of their own, and those were Democrats. President Obama has promised an 83% cut in U.S. greenhouse gas emissions from their 2005 level by the year 2050, but such extravagant pledges are only possible when everyone knows they won't happen. Yesterday's announcement by the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, that it will regulate carbon as a dangerous pollutant is an attempt to run around Congress in order to impress Copenhagen's conferees. But it is also deeply undemocratic, and it betrays the lack of broader public support. I'm going to continue with this Wall Street Journal editorial, but let me take you to Russia. Here is how they're talking about the climate change conference on Russia today.
It is 4 o'clock now on a Wednesday afternoon. RT coming to you live from Moscow. It's good to have you with us. As the Copenhagen Climate Summit reaches its midpoint, over 100 global warming skeptics have gathered to challenge the UN conference. They want scientists to back up their theories with facts before demanding emission cuts. RT's Laura Emmett has been following their meeting.
Throwing down the gauntlet, skeptics have issued a climate challenge, an open letter to the United Nations requesting scientific evidence man is causing dangerous climate change. Tom Harris of the International Climate Science Coalition is behind it.
We hear constantly from the United Nations, the time for debate is over. The science is settled. We have to take extreme action to prevent catastrophe. But what many of the scientists in the world are saying is the science is really just beginning, that this is a very immature field, and it's in a field of what, it's in an era of negative discovery. In other words, the more we learn, the more we realize we don't understand.
The letters signed by 150 top climate scientists. They request demonstrative proof on 10 points, ranging from variations in climate to the frequency of storms. Some of them object to the science behind climate change, but some just don't think the UN's revealed enough data to justify the radical approach to carbon emissions represented by the Copenhagen conference.
They are dismissing a very complex and beautiful picture of interdisciplinary, interrelated science. So I think the climate movement has taken us back 1,000 years.
These sceptics say they're as green as the next man. They don't like pollution and they advocate finding alternatives to fossil fuels. But they insist carbon dioxide is not a pollutant and that market forces should dictate the development of renewable energy sources, not restrictive government policy.
The fossil fuel age will end, sure as night follows day, because we have better technology. It is coming. And one of the things that I'm very keen about is to make sure we have a clean environment.
The scientists say they're not trying to provoke a row with the UN experts.
What we're trying to do is open a third way, where it's a more rational way, where we ask questions, we share information back and forth, and we come to conclusions that we believe, really believe, will benefit the environment and society.
It's in this unlikely-looking setting that the climate change skeptics are holding their alternative meeting. It's a far cry from the 15,000-strong conference just a few kilometres down the road. But the influence of this alternative movement is growing, and this direct request for information ups the ante. The sceptics say they'll keep pushing until they get an answer. Laura Emmett, RT, Copenhagen.
Okay, I hope you listened closely. That was Russia now. That wasn't left, right, CNN, Fox, MSNBC stuff.
Cedric Mohammed.